You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
I just read a great new novel. It's called Never Saw Me Coming. You'll love it too. Order it right now and you can thank me later. I know nothing about the author, but it turns out that when you have a radio show about books and you write the publisher and ask for an interview with the author, they sometimes say yes. And that is the case with Vera Kurian, the author of Never Saw Me Coming. Let's meet her right now. Vera Kurian, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me.
I want to thank you for making time for us at the end of your busy work day, in the middle of your work week. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's actually something to look forward to in the middle of a week.
So in addition to being my new favorite novelist, what kind of work is it that you do?
I'm a social psychologist, so people frequently mistake me for a clinical psychologist who they assume that I work with psychopaths because that's what the book is about. But no, I do a lot of like quantitative work, and I studied politics in grad school, so it had nothing to do with psychopaths at all.
That just came to you, just popped into your head.
As a true crime fan, I'd always been interested in them, and kind of been adjacent to clinical psychology, so I became interested more in the topic for the book.
Well, you know, most people are like English history people, or they're science and math people. So you're a science person that writes. That's maybe more unusual.
Yeah, I'm like, sorry, I hope you can't hear that siren. I live by a firehouse.
They're coming to you.
I'm kind of squarely in the middle. I mean, I never wanted to be a full-time writer, but I was interested in the sciences, and then writing was just kind of my hobby. But people always ask me like, well, now that your book came out, are you going to quit working? I was like, well, there's an itch that is scratched by doing that type of scientific work that isn't scratched by writing, and vice versa. So I like to do them both.
But you're going to be writing more. This is your first novel, but not your last one.
It's my first published novel. Yeah. And not my last. I mean, I've written a few novels before this.
A few.
So yeah, I wrote one in high school, the inevitable vampire novel you write in high school. And then I wrote three novels before this one, and you know, kind of recently, post 2013. And then this was the third one that I attempted to get an agent for.
This one. So why do you think this one caught on?
Honestly, I think if I had kept at it with the first two, I probably would have gotten an agent at some point. But this book has a very like viral feel to it. And I think like judging from the way that publisher snapped it up, like how quickly and how much they wanted it, and TV rights and stuff, there's something viral about the book that people...
TV rights? Has that happened?
Yeah, I mean, we sold the options, so you know, who even knows if that will happen. But that happened in the middle of the beginning of the pandemic, where didn't even know if Hollywood would exist 6 months from now. So I think when I wrote the book, I remember thinking, if I can't get an agent for this book, there is no book I can write that will get an agent, because it just had such a like propulsive viral feel and like really strong, interesting characters. So it's not surprising to me, looking back on my three books, that this is the one that hit.
So do you think now publishers will be interested in your previous two, and we'll see them as well?
I think that I would shelf the first one. It's kind of a strange thing to say, but it's a very Obama era book. Like it kind of only made sense during
it's
that
dated now, yeah.
8 year period. It kind of doesn't quite make sense post 2016. The second one was intended to be a science fiction series, which I have this like enormous series planned out in my head. I just haven't sat down and written it, but maybe at some point. Definitely not my next few books, I think, will be something else other than that though.
So do you have like a bunch of stories that are like rattling around in your brain that you can't wait to get out?
Yeah, I mean, I typically have most of an idea worked out in my head before I start writing it. So the book that I'm writing currently, during the pandemic, when we were doing the sort of administrative work to get Never Saw Me Coming published, I was working on plotting this book, but kind of plotted all of it out before I ever sat down to write it at all, and like worked out all the characters before I even wrote a single word of it.
And you knew how it would end and how you would get to the end.
For pretty much everything I write, for Never Saw Me Coming, I think if you look on my blog, there's a clipping of a Facebook post that I made in September 2017 that said something like, "Hey guys, I got an idea for a book," and it basically was the book, in a couple sentences. And then I didn't clip this, but there's a post a few down where I said, "And the person who did it is such and such." And I knew right from the beginning who did it. And then I think for a mystery, at least in my opinion, you need to kind of work out that architecture so that you can go back and drop clues so that you have like a reasonably structured mystery.
Not like Lost.
I could go on and on about plotting and Lost.
Because it's a mystery and we don't want to spoil anything for anybody. So tell us what my listeners need to know so that they will run out and buy your book.
Sure. So Never Saw Me Coming is about an 18-year-old incoming college student named Chloe. She's a freshman. She is a diagnosed psychopath and she's entering a special program at this university in Washington, D.C., where you get to go to college for free in exchange for being in this program. And there are 7 psychopaths total at the school. But what she is really there to do is hunt down and kill this boy from her past who goes to the same school. But what she doesn't know is that someone in the city is hunting down the 7 psychopaths in the program one by one. So she kind of has to decide, should I work with some of the other people? Are they trustworthy? No one can trust anyone because they are all psychopaths.
Now, do you mean this book to be a parable of sorts about trust and relationships?
I write stuff that's very like high concept where, the actual pitch of the book is kind of like absurd. I think that I have the absurd concept, but then I try to execute them with the skills of someone with a literary fiction background. So I think that I was playing with a lot of tropes that I had observed in psychological thrillers in the past decade, and trying to fill a hole that hadn't been filled before, but also to play with tropes in a way that was unexpected and like fun and interesting for people who read thrillers regularly.
Yeah, well, it's definitely all of those things. And so again, now trying to stay away from spoilers, are there any characters that you could see that they would come back and you would have further adventures of?
I get asked that a lot. Yeah. So my next book will not be a sequel. I do think somewhere down the line, maybe, especially since we sold the TV rights. If it does get turned into a TV show, there's clearly an enormous incentive to write more books. They own the IP for them. So we'll find out. I mean, I love the character of Chloe and the other 2 characters who were introduced. And I've set up a situation where there's a nice setting of college and then these kids are going to keep getting in trouble clearly. And like, it's set up to have a sequel. Yeah. I kind of did that on purpose, but I guess we'll see. Ask me in a couple of years.
Okay. There have been other stories that are similar, nothing like yours, but at the same time, the idea of a bunch of young people getting involved in a murder mystery. Hardy Boys and Scooby-Doo and aiming for what else? What were some of the things that you were...
Well, I think that so a lot of psychological thrillers in the past year have focused on wives and mothers, and I'm neither of those things, and as are a lot of people my age and younger. So I wanted a younger protagonist, and I love the college setting. But I think in terms of tropes, one, I wanted to play with some ideas about unreliable narrators. Mm-hmm. Also, the likable, unlikable female character. I think that a lot of thrillers have been focusing a lot on twists, and I'm very anti-twist, actually. And I think people have the expectation of there being a kind of crazy twist, and then you're actually told a pretty traditional, old-fashioned mystery, as far as I'm concerned. I think the ending, without spoiling it, is me kind of making fun of twists, in my opinion. But it's kind of been interesting to see people talk about, all the characters in this book are unreliable narrators. Whereas, I would say that none of them are.
You don't think any of them are unreliable? They're all
no. I mean, an unreliable narrator is someone who lies to the reader.
Right.
These are people who you sort of think that they will, but they actually never lie to the reader. They lie to each other. And I knew that there were some people. This isn't a spoiler, as far as I'm concerned. There are some people who are going to think that maybe Chloe did it all along, even though she's like, "Oh no, I don't want to be murdered," but maybe she's the one who did it. And the reason for that is that there are a lot of thrillers where the final twist at the end is that the narrator did it.
Yeah, there's an Agatha Christie, and I can't think of which Agatha
Christie. Oh, is Dan Aykroyd.
Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd.
He didn't show anyone. Yeah, I think that was incredibly innovative in like 1912 or whenever she wrote it, and I don't think it's innovative anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Dan Aykroyd, he'd be upset. what other writers that inspire you? I mean, if not Agatha Christie, I mean, since she's sort of the beginning of murder mystery.
Yeah.
But who have you read and who do you like to read?
I mean, I think Gone Girl was clearly like an influence on this book. I think it just, you know, kind of, it's been my high watermark for me. I read literary fiction, but I actually grew up with a lot of Stephen King. Mm. And I think he, like me, is kind of an old-fashioned storyteller. Like, yes, there might be a ridiculous concept or a monster or whatever, but he is really focused on character and very traditional storytelling, where he's not necessarily doing something crazy with structure or reader expectations. It's just, here are some characters, here's them dealing with something, and then, you know, let them go play. A lot of the literary fiction writers that I really admire are writers that do things that I can't do. And so they're really lyrical or something along those lines. And I always read a lot of literary fiction because I hope that it makes me a better writer.
Well, I'm sure it does. I mean, you're a really, really good writer. Stephen King, his crime stories. I mean, he does a lot of, I don't know, they're not exactly... Like I said, horror stuff. But he does a lot of crime fiction that's really just straight ahead crime fiction that I love.
I think that a lot of people mischaracterize him as solely a horror writer. If you think like if another writer had written Misery, especially like a writer's writer, like a Jonathan Franzen type had written that book, I think people would have responded to it really differently. There really is a very psychological book, and it gets really in depth to describe what it is like to be a writer. In a way that no other novel I've read has done. And it's frightening in a way that's not dependent on ghosts and ghoulies. It's just this like crazy woman and you're trapped in a bed. It's such a great premise.
Yeah. And there's no supernatural events in that book. And I kind of prefer it when they're not supernatural because I guess, cause I'm a non-believer. So whenever
it's more scary, I think.
Yeah. It's more believable. It could happen.
Yeah, it could happen to you, whereas I'm not worried about a monster.
Yeah, not too much. A little bit. I'm worried about Dan Aykroyd coming after me.
I made an enemy. Powerful enemy.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with novelist Vera Kurian. Her new book is called Never Saw Me Coming. What about TV? Are there TV shows that you like to watch?
Oh yeah. I mean, I watch everything from the most like fancy prestige television Succession to like the most absolute trash. Like after this interview, I'm going to watch The Bachelor. I really watch a lot of TV, and a lot of writers will never say that.
That's right.
I think that TV.
I don't even have a TV.
Oh yeah. Oh no. All the time. Yeah. I mean, I go through long periods of time where I'm not doing any writing and I watch a lot of TV. I think you can learn. I think right now, especially, a lot of people are doing such interesting things with TV that they were not doing when I was younger, where you could do like long form stories, where it would have been a movie 10 years ago. And now it's an entire show with 10 episodes where they get 10 hours to tell a story. So you could do a really
or more
storytelling. Yeah.
I mean, Mad Men is like a 75-hour movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Mad Men is like the TV equivalent of a literary novel, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
I would say the same thing of Succession too. Like, who even cares about the company? You know, it's about the characters that are like really, really well written and really well acted.
Yeah, and The Bachelor. Wow.
You know, The Bachelor is just like reality TV in general. To me, is interesting because it's just basically a social experiment. where they do these things to these contestants that you would never get away with in a psychology lab. So it's kind of like inhumane, but you, I don't know. I do feel like there's like something to learn from watching people. I've, you know, learned a lot about human behavior, or like people's perceptions about dating or how other people appear, just from watching, like, oh, I just sort of assumed that maybe hyper attractive people are more intelligent about these things. But it turns out that they're not.
They're just better looking. And what about the movies?
Pre-COVID, I went to the movies constantly because I live near a theater and there's another theater right attached to my gym. So I would basically see any movie that people were talking about, and definitely any horror movie, because I'm a big, big horror fan. I've only been to the movies two or three times since COVID. And the first time I was like, oh, maybe I'm not ready.
Yeah.
It wasn't because of the crowd. It was because I went to see A Quiet Place 2 and these two girls were talking.
This is a quiet place.
No, I was extremely aggravated. You have the luxury when you're watching at home where no one's talking.
That's right.
But yeah, lately I've been watching a lot of horror movies at home, including some of the like prestige horror movies that are supposed to be more, you know,
better than the average horror movie.
Yeah, and typically they are. I mean, sometimes they're a little ridiculous, but I end up thinking about them more than a basic slash.
Do you think any of that TV movie stuff affects your writing or in any way? Yeah,
I definitely think so. I mean, I think I had one editor, an editor of a novella I wrote, said that my writing was very cinematic. And I think it's because when I'm writing the book, I see it like in the form of like a movie, with some interiority of like knowing what the characters are thinking. And then I just write that down. So I'm very like visual in that respect. And I think TV has kind of trained me to be that way. So I definitely, and also TV has a lot of dialogue too. And I think a very dialogue focused writer.
Yeah. So in your work, what is it? I mean, you said what it is, but I don't really know what that is. So what do you do all day in your work life?
I'll do a lot of data analysis, like data mining. If you're familiar with that, it's large data sets.
Yeah.
If you have a large data set. So for example, there's a general social survey, or like the American National Election Study, giant data sets that like many, many scientists will look at. And then you go into them and you can look for things. So you either have a hypothesis or you're just fishing. So a lot of my graduate work looked at things like political ideology, and how it relates to things like policy preferences. The lab that I worked in did a lot of stuff about racism in kind of a modern context and what that looks like. Although I think that research is now outdated.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what we were thinking about racism when I was in grad school in the late 2008 was quite different than what happened a few years later, where people were kind of openly saying old fashioned racist things, which we thought was something on the downtrend. Now
away.
I actually think it means that there's a younger generation of people saying old fashioned racist things, when we used to believe that old fashioned racism was associated with older people and that it would sort of slowly die down as people literally died. And I don't think that's what happened at all.
So it's not like right now this is like a last gasp of the older racists who are fearing their world being taken away from them, but rather a young influx of new racism is what you're saying.
I think it's both. I mean, I was very unpleasantly surprised to see people who are pretty young saying things like they believe in genetic differences by race in terms of intelligence, of like that is an old debunked idea. And so now there's like a crop of younger people espousing these same things, which is not what I would have believed if you had told me that in 2005.
Well, because now it doesn't matter if something has been debunked by somebody, because then there's somebody else who debunks the debunker and says this.
Yeah, you can just kind of go into your own bubble of other people who similarly agree that vaccines are bad or what have you. And it's been a rough 2 years.
Yeah, it's kind of frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And so do you think that work influences your writing too?
I mean, I think as someone who's always been so focused on psychology, I've always been interested in human behavior, and I'm hoping that that leads to very like three-dimensional characters. I mean, sometimes I wonder if I would I have ended up being a writer if I had just majored in like accounting or something. And I don't know, I always loved reading from a really young age. And then that sort of inevitably led to like writing my own stories. So yeah, I'm not sure what I would have ended up doing writing wise.
Your previous novels and short stories, and I know you've been published in various literary magazines and so forth, do they have murders in them or not?
So no, my short stories were all literary, and they were either very straightforward literary, or they were a little bit weird, like in the vein of Donald Barthelmore or Italo Calvino, like that kind of stuff. And then the first novel was a straight literary novel. And then the second was science fiction. It was like military science fiction. So yes, people were getting killed, but in the context of war. But no, I'd never written a mystery before.
Ah, but now you're a mystery writer.
I guess so, yeah. My next book is a mystery too. So I guess I read a fair amount of mystery. I don't read like detective fiction or like FBI. It's typically like a amateur sleuth type of mystery. And I'd read a lot of psychological thrillers too. And that's probably why I ended up writing one. I'd just been reading a lot of them.
Well, I guess it's fun to have a crime in your story. I mean, it kind of propels the story forward in a way.
I mean, it clearly makes the stakes of like, well, someone's trying to kill me. I mean, the problem with a thriller is the like breakneck pace that you have to write it at. It doesn't leave you a lot of room for flourishes, I would say. I mean, I was thinking about Never Saw Me Coming. I think there's only two flashbacks in it total. That doesn't give you a ton of space to just like let the characters spread their wings a little. But that's what you have to do in a thriller. Even though I think this is a very fast-paced book, there was maybe 5 or 10% of readers who were like, oh, the middle dragged a little. And then some people were like, it went so fast and I enjoyed it, but I wanted to spend more time with the characters.
Yes, that was me. I was like, sorry that it ended so fast. Like, wait a minute, I'm at the end.
Yeah, and I mean, construct the book so that it's devoured fast, quickly. Yeah. And then, but then the reader does that, and then they're like, oh, I got to the end. You know, they didn't really get to enjoy it.
Well, I know I enjoyed it tremendously. But so maybe that's a good, I mean, that's nice for you that people didn't want to put it down. You know, as they say, I couldn't put it down. Yeah. And the book has really taken off. I mean, there was a blurb in the New York Times book review on crime, and that was kind of cool to see it there.
Yeah, I think they pretty much nailed my brand. She says like the premise of the book is absurd, but it's done with panache and wit. And I was like, that's basically what I do. I do absurd premises and then I try to do them well. But I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, that's very nice. And so have you heard from readers? Well, I mean, I guess now, you know, because of this internet deal, people can review your book instantly on Goodreads and Amazon and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting to switch from being like a regular person who was on Goodreads to being an author, because like then you have this endless repository of people making comments about you. And like at first I was reading all my reviews, and all the authors that I know who are 2021 debuts were like, don't do it. And it is a bad idea, because you get stuck in your you get fixated on the negative reviews, and then it makes it hard to write. But I'm also on Instagram, and so then people will tag you and then you see feedback. And I've gotten really great feedback. But there's also negative feedback. And then you're like, well, how do I interpret looking at my own Goodreads rating, knowing how I rate books, and like, well, why isn't it a 5-star, you know? But then you realize, you know, it's a whole population of people reading the book, and not every reader is like you or like your friends. You know, they might be looking for something else, or they might really dig it and get it, or they might not get it. Some people read this book and like, the characters are all terrible people. I mean, they're psychopaths. They're not supposed to be good people.
Well, and I want to ask you two questions about that. A lot of writers have told me that their characters, like they went into the book, you know, with an idea, and they knew where they were going, as you said you did. but then their characters kind of surprised them and even took over part of the book that they didn't expect. Mm. Did any of that happen to you?
The only thing that surprised me is in the first draft, we know that Chloe's kind of like a shallow person, and part of the reason that she's attracted to the boy she likes is just because of the way he looks and he's wealthy and stuff. And there's in the first draft, there's a scene where she decides that she's in love with him. And one of the early readers who was an agent giving me feedback was like, I don't know if I buy that. And I thought about it and I was like, actually, now that I know who Chloe is as a person, I actually think that she's someone who would be very guarded about being in love with someone. I'm not even sure if she's capable of being in love with someone. So I actually went back on that. And I think that adds to a better tension between her and her love interest, is that she wants this person, but what is she going to do if she actually gets them? You know, would she be satisfied then? I don't think so.
No, you also write some sex scenes. And I wonder how that is. I mean, do you, it's hard to ask this question. So, I mean, and they're good sex scenes, but I mean, how do you feel about writing them? Was that your first go at it? Did you have to rewrite them?
No. So I used to previously do like Fade to Black. And then when I wrote this book with that character, I was like, no, I think I would have to like write it, which like, I'm not a British person, but it's like so like uncomfortable. I don't like, I have read my work out loud to proofread it. Like, I hate reading the part out loud. I hate that people have read it. I've listened to the audio book of my own book and I have to like kind of be like during that part. But it's, I mean, I don't know why it's been a very American thing to be so squeamish about sex, but it was like really necessary for who the character is and I think for who the genre too.
Yeah, it's not, there's nothing obscene in the book.
It's not graphic, no, but it's not tame, I would say either. So,
yeah, has your mother read the book?
I don't want anyone to read it. That's not true. I want people to read it, but I don't want anyone who like, you know, is older than me.
Well, it's a good thing you and I are the same age. What about this psychopath program that you write about? Is there any such thing? Did you make it up completely?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, the inspiration for the book was I'd heard about these, it's very difficult to treat psychopathy. And there are some treatment facilities that are juvenile detention centers where they developed a protocol to help young boys with psychopathy, where in order to get them to behave right, they couch everything in terms of the kid's self-interest. So it's not like you shouldn't hit that kid because it hurts them, because they won't care because they have empathy. It's like, if you don't hit that kid, then you get 10 minutes of TV time or something. So because they don't have a conscience, they work to create a cognitive conscience rather than like an emotional one. So I'd heard about that. I thought it was really interesting. And I was like, oh, you know, what if there was a whole school like that? And then I thought this whole entire school was too much. So then I did 7, because I kind of wanted it to have like a little bit of a locked room feel, although technically it's not. But that there would be an element of knowing like, who are the 7? It could be literally anyone. And then the like miss part of the mystery is figuring out who's who through 1 through 7.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's kind of like the X-Men also.
Their secret power is their psychopathy. I mean, I really wanted to get it right. I actually was contacted by a PhD, a psychology PhD at Georgetown who studies psychopaths. And she was reading the book and she was like, why is this book accurate? And then saw that I had a background in psychology. So that was really cool. And I was like, okay, I got it right. If the person who studies psychopaths is all right with it.
Is it possible if you find a young person who's been diagnosed this way, can you cure them? Or is this just a thing that's always going to be there?
That's what I asked her. And she said, like, people can be helped. It's not like you can, you know, change it entirely, because like it's generally believed amongst a certain part of the population that it's something you're born with, that your brain is actually different. She believes that they can be improved, but that it's not easy and that they would actually have to actively seek help. But part of the problem is if you're narcissistic, you don't think there's anything wrong with you, but you might have to be like, there's a pattern in your life where all of your relationships end and people don't want to talk to you. Would you like to change that? And then they might be willing to work on it.
I love the book, which is why I asked Vera Kurian to come and talk about it. It's called Never Saw Me Coming, and it's a great novel. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to your next one.
Might be a few years, but yes.
And I hope you'll come back to From the Bookshelf and talk to us about it.
Sure. Give me a call.
Novelist Vera Kurian. Her debut novel is called Never Saw Me Coming. You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
I am so pleased to welcome Carrie Mayer back to the show this week. Carrie Mayer has written some great historical novels about interesting women, and her novels do what biographies can't. They take us inside the thoughts and dreams of her subject, using great research and her vivid imagination and ear for dialogue. Her books include The Kennedy Debutante, about Kathleen Kick Kennedy, the forgotten and rebellious daughter of one of America's greatest political dynasties; The Girl in White Gloves, a novel of Grace Kelly; and her new book, The Paris Bookseller, which takes us to Paris in the roaring 20s with a cast of literary greats. Carrie Mayer, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
I love your new book. And why don't you, I mean, it's interesting with a historical novel. It's not like you can give stuff away, but at the same time, I don't want to give anything away. So what should our readers, listeners know about The Paris Bookseller?
Well, it is about the remarkable woman, American woman, Sylvia Beach, who opened the original Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris in 1919. And it very quickly became really the home of the lost generation writers, you know, all those famous writers from the 20s and into the 30s that you've heard of, who expatriated or visited Paris. F. Scott Fitzgerald, Gertrude Stein, Ernest Hemingway was a lifelong friend of hers. Ezra Pound, you know, just really all of them, all the way through Henry Miller, John Dos Passos, you know, all the names. But as if that wasn't enough, she also published the very first edition of James Joyce's novel, Ulysses, in 1922. So we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of her edition of Ulysses. But what's especially remarkable about that is that she did it after it had been banned. It became a banned book in 1921, following a large obscenity trial in New York City. So she published this book in English from Paris after the American and British publishers had all withdrawn their offers to publish it. And then she had to smuggle it back into the United States alongside all the illegal liquor because, you know, it's prohibition. So it's a great story.
It is a great story. And I got from your novel that she didn't just publish it. I mean, she's practically the editor of the book. I mean, she's the one that took it from handwritten notes to.
Oh, my gosh. She had more than 12 typists working on this thing, and she allowed Joyce to write, or rewrite, I should say, a third of the novel on the page proofs. So, you know, she'd get back the typeset pages from the printer in Dijon and like give them to Joyce, you know, for like, to make sure that they're correct. And he scribbled all over them and like rewrote the book on the page proofs. And it's funny, like I always like, this is sort of a funny thing for a modern writer to realize was ever the case, because now in most, almost all contracts that modern writers sign, like there's a provision that says you're not allowed to change more than 10% of the novel at the page proof stage. Otherwise you have to pay to reset the type. Wow. And I almost want to like say thank you, James Joyce, for making sure that this is a provision in my publishing contract.
Well, so it must have been very costly then for Sylvia Beach to tackle this. Did she make any money on the publication?
You know, it's really hard to tell. And I think, you know, her own writings say it's hard to tell whether or not she ever made any money. I think she says that she never made any money from publishing Ulysses. You know, what Ulysses really brought her and she really valued the most. I mean, she had a deep and abiding and complicated friendship with Joyce himself. And that was very important to her. But, you know, publishing Ulysses brought a great deal of notoriety to the store. So she really felt like Ulysses and Joyce as a fixture in the store helped her as a bookseller in Paris.
In your first novel, I think it was your first one, the Kick Kennedy one.
Yes.
And that was set, I guess, mostly in the 30s and 40s. And then you had your book about Grace Kelly, which is in the 50s. And now you're back in the 20s. How did you come to this place and want to write this story?
Oh, you know, in some ways, I'm amazed it took me so long to figure out that Sylvia deserved her own novel. I've actually been carrying her story around with me in my heart and mind since I was a college student. I've always been kind of obsessed with the 1920s and those writers and the whole idea of expatriating to Paris, because, you know, it's, I mean, hey, Paris, right? And so, you know, as a young English major in college, I, you know, took all the classes that were based in this time period. I did my own, you know, pleasure reading and immersed myself in the writing of this time. And, you know, one day, you know, like in any college town, there are those great, you know, used book bins in front of all the bookstores. So one day I found Sylvia Beach wrote her own memoir, which is called Shakespeare and Company. It's a little book. It's a slim book. I plucked it out of a bargain bin one day. You know, I purchased it for a dollar. I read it. I was entranced by her story. You know, I just thought, wow, you know, here was this other major character in this historical moment that I was interested in. I thought it was fascinating that she had published Ulysses, but you know, I was like 20 when I was reading this book. So I just kind of filed it away in my mind under good to know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so I wrote the Kennedy debutante and then The Girl in White Gloves. And then when I was sort of like looking around for a third subject, Sylvia and her story occurred to me very quickly. And I was just thrilled that, you know, my publisher was as excited about her story as I was. But you know, in some ways, even though I say I'm amazed that it took me so long, I'm also glad that it did, because I think that writing about Kick and Grace first kind of gave me the gumption to take on Sylvia and, Ernest Hemingway and James Joyce.
And there's also the issue of her being a lesbian in the 1920s. How did that factor into her life and her story?
Well, it was of paramount importance. You know, I think for modern readers, it's an interesting relationship to read. So without this doesn't this is not a major spoiler. One of her inspirations for opening Shakespeare and Company is a bookstore that is across the street from hers on the Rue de l'Odéon called La Maison des Amis de Livres, the House of the Friends of Books, which was opened by a French woman in 1919 named Adrienne Monnier. And Sylvia stops into this store on her own in 1917, and that's how she discovers Adrienne and her store. And she essentially falls in love with both Adrienne and her store. And she and Adrienne become a couple after she opens Shakespeare and Company and form a really beautiful and fruitful partnership, romantic partnership and business partnership. They don't co-own each other's stores, but when Sylvia is able to move the location of her shop to the Rue de l'Odéon and be across the street from La Maison, Adrienne calls their two stores and that block of Paris Odéonia, as if it's like this mythical place of literary genius, you know, where genius can flourish and bohemian ideas can flow uncensored. And so, you know, having Adrienne as not just her friend, but her romantic partner, I think was just so important in Sylvia's development as a bookseller and an intellectual.
The first time that I went to Paris many, many years ago, I went to Shakespeare and Company, but the one that I went to was a different store. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. Yes. It's very, so I have also been to the current Shakespeare and Company, which is itself a magical, wonderful place with a history of its own. So Sylvia's store had to sadly close down during the First World War. The Second World War. and Sylvia doesn't reopen, but, Shakespeare and Company, the current Shakespeare and Company, was opened in 1951 under a different name, Le Mistral, by another American named George Whitman. And Sylvia was a regular at that that store in the 50s. And George Whitman renamed Le Mistral Shakespeare and Company in, I believe it was 1964, on the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. And so and also as an homage to Sylvia's original shop. And if you go to today's Shakespeare and Company, there is all kinds of wonderful plaques and ephemera describing the history of the original store. So the beating heart of the current store is the original, even though they're not actually connected or in the same location.
Right. That one is in a completely different spot. And it's a lovely spot, actually.
It's a lovely spot. I mean, it has a cafe next door. You order a coffee and you're looking right at Notre Dame Cathedral. Like, it just doesn't get any better than that.
So when you were researching, Carrie Mara, when you were researching your new book, The Paris Bookseller, did you have to go to Paris?
I did. It was a terrible, awful thing, like such a burden. It's all joking aside, historical novelists write about other places and times without getting to visit them all the time. So I feel very privileged that I was able to do it. And I was able to do it before the pandemic hit. I went to Paris in the summer of 2019. And I spent a week there kind of soaking it up. And I had been to Paris before, but it had been many, many, many years. So I was glad that I got to refresh my memory and visit the current store and go back to the original blocks that the Sylvia stores were on. And I had the great good fortune also of staying in what is very likely the same building that James Joyce and his family lived in 1921, the summer of 1921, when he was finishing Ulysses. I found it on Airbnb, of all places. It was advertised.
That's probably where Joyce found it as well.
Right, exactly, right? It was advertised as James Joyce flat. No one knows what the actual flat was, but it was definitely one of the flats on this beautiful building on this lovely leafy courtyard. In the left bank. It was a magical week.
Well, you do such a great job of bringing the characters to life. And so in addition to going to Paris, what kinds of research did you do into all of the characters that you bring?
Well, I felt very fortunate that I got to bring, much of a lifetime of reading to this book. Because I had been, The Great Gatsby is one of my favorite novels. I love The Sun Also Rises and A Movable Feast. I love that book. And I had already read Sylvia's memoir, but of course I reread it. So there were a number of other, volumes of her letters to Joyce and to other friends that I definitely took a close look at. There's also a definitive biography of Sylvia Beach by a woman named Noelle Riley Fitch called Sylvia Beach and the Lost Generation, which was, I really read very carefully cover to cover. It's just a great book. If you're interested in a deeper dive into this time in the store, I highly recommend it. And then there were two books that have been published very recently, two nonfiction books about the trial of Ulysses in the courts. It actually came to trial twice, once in 1921 and then later in the 30s. And those books were very important for me to understand the kind of what was legally at stake in those trials. So I did that research. I refreshed my memory of A Movable Feast and some of the other, kind of the novels. There was Adrienne Monnier hasn't been fully translated into English, but part of her memoir has been translated, and I definitely read quite a lot of that. There was one of the American publishers of Ulysses in the avant-garde literary journals. This is actually the woman who stood trial for publishing Ulysses. Her name is Margaret Anderson. She wrote a memoir that I read. So, it was very free-ranging. Truly, one of my challenges in writing this book was to know when to stop researching and start writing, because this is such a famous time about such famous people who were writers. I could have done research for this book for a decade and never sat down to write. So I had to kind of be firm with myself. And, I kind of know when scenes start forming in my mind, is sort of when it's time to, I think, put my own pen to paper.
Well, and it's wonderful. You do a great job of bringing it all to life, Carrie Mara. But what's going to happen next? You have a fourth book in mind?
I do. It's still in the writing stages, so I'm feeling a little superstitious about it. But totally different decade, though. I'll tell you that.
Okay.
yet another 20th century decade.
And you promised to come back and talk to us about that one.
Of course, of course.
Good. This one is called The Paris Bookseller, and the author, the brilliant Carrie Mayer. Thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time talking to you today.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.